The final edition Radio Hour is a work of satire intended for audiences who own books, gentrify neighborhoods, and say they like kale. Please consume responsibly, the satire, that is.
I'm Jeff Chrysler.
And I'm Tony Hendra.
And this is the final edition Radio Hour.
We have an eclectic show for you this week, driven, of course, by the miracle of eclecticity. Interestingly enough, this year is the 180th anniversary of the discovery of eclecticity by Michael Faraday, who, by the by, was Albert Einstein's favourite scientist.
Shut up, Tony. Einstein? This week, Justin Bieber's biggest and oldest fan defends the androgynous Canadian dwarf's racism, and we have yet another exclusive interview with the utterly darling potty-mouthed Prince George of England.
On the subject of Brits, we also reveal the NFL plans for a British football franchise. And June, being the peak of the whale spotting season, we take you on a dreamy trip off the California coast to experience the humpback whale's majestic farts.
As is our policy, we have not touched with a very tall pole the big stories of the week, like the rescue of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, but it is somewhat satirical that John McCain, who criticized Obama for ages for not getting the sergeant safely home, now is criticizing Obama for getting him home because people are saying he might have consorted with the enemy.
Of course, no one ever said that about John McCain.
Tony, lighten up. The man's a hero.
So good Subway sandwich. And it sucks. As for real heroes, let's not forget that today is the 70th anniversary of the D-Day landing.
Yeah, when we pulled your chestnuts out of the fire.
Indeed. Speaking of testicles, the D-Day landing, thanks to Steven Spielberg, also gave the world the greatest porn film title of all time, Saving Ryan's Privates.
With Albert Einstein. So hang on to your battered helmets and charge up the beach with...
The final edition Radio Hour.
All right, let's go. There's gonna be one less lonely girl.
Hello, my name is Ronald Williamson, and I am the president of the Toledo, Ohio chapter of the Justin Bieber fan club. I am also 42 years old, making me the oldest member of any Justin Bieber fan club. I don't care what Martin Scott of Des Moines, Iowa says. I saw his Skype profile. There's no way he's 42. This is hard. So, in light of Justin's recent controversy involving a racist joke about chainsaws and black people, I'd like to issue the following statement. You leave him alone. You leave Justin alone. So what if he's a Nazi? He's my Nazi. My little Canadian Nazi. And if he wants to tell jokes and hate races, you let him. You let that little sweet Canadian boy hate all the races. Except his race. The Bieber race. You all think he's the first pop star to tell racist jokes? I bet Joey Fatone used to have racist joke Thursdays, and I bet Justin Timberlake stayed and listened and laughed. He isn't so perfect. The One Direction guys beat up hobos for fun. There, I said it. Coldplay owned slaves. Oh, but let's all pick on beautiful Justin Bieber and his racist jokes. Robin Thicke doesn't tip Jews, and Pharrell drops pennies in front of them and then makes them dance for it. But hey, Perez Hilton doesn't want to talk about that. You lay off my Bieber world. He just wants to be racist. Let him be racist. His fans encourage it. We want it. I hope he makes a racist joke about me.
Dad? What are you doing in my room?
Defending my Bieber.
Get out of my room!
Bieber!
Get out of my clothes! Oh, yuck!
Bieber.
A message from the NRA.
Whenever a mass number of people get shot, everyone blames the guns that can shoot a mass number of people and were used in those particular mass shootings of people. But these murders have more important things in common. We talked to the real experts.
You know every one of these shooters has been to a doctor at some point. Maybe a dentist or a podiatrist, but before they turned violent, they got examined by someone who studied blood and bodies. Now, how do you think that's going to turn out?
Every mass shooter, at some point in their lives, took baby aspirin.
Aspirin for babies?
Yeah, and they probably took it when they were babies. I'm telling you, the shootings with guns are a false flag. Why isn't anybody talking about the baby aspirin?
Look at how old these shooters are, 20, 24, 34. Every single one of them was alive during the Clinton administration.
That's true. So what's the connection between the Clintons and mass shootings?
You don't see the connection? How can you miss the connection? Benghazi!
I know why there are so many victims, because they were asking for it, like those kids in Newtown. Did you see how they were dressed?
We at the NRA do care about mass shootings, so we're fighting to stop doctors, baby aspirin, the 1990s, and people just walking around asking to be killed. And finally, we're fighting to put an end to liquid paper, because that's how much we care.
This is MSNBC's Midday. I'm sitting in for your regular host, whose name doesn't matter. And my name also doesn't matter. As regular viewers know, we here at MSNBC have a great sense of humor now and then. So in the interest of perhaps being funnier at some point, MSNBC Midday asks, what is humor? And should it be regulated? Joining me now are a couple of humor experts, Salon.com writer Michael Hadley Stevens, Porter III.
Hello.
And MSNBC host Daryl trying to sound like Rachel Maddow.
Hi there.
Michael Hadley Stevens, Porter III, let me start with you. Based on your experience as a political writer, what is comedy?
Well, comedy is the art of making a cogent political point, utilizing colorful analogies without offending anyone.
That's what I always suspected.
If I may interject.
Yes, Daryl, trying to sound like Rachel Maddow.
We might broaden our definition. Humor can also mean finding something tacky in politics and smiling gleefully while you tell people about it.
Ah, yes, that is absolutely hilarious. Michael Hadley Stevens Porter III, what is a joke?
Well, a real joke has at least three elements. There has to be a punchline somewhere in the joke, perhaps in the middle. There's a setup, which, as the name implies, occurs early in a joke. Finally, every good joke ends with a call to action. For example, a doctor gave a man 6 months to live. The man couldn't pay his bill, so he gave him another 6 months. Please call your congressman. Bam! Setup, punchline, call to action.
It would have been funnier if it specifically linked the doctor's behavior to the Affordable Care Act.
Ah, agreed.
How about this? The doctor says to the patient, take your clothes off and stick your tongue out the window. The patient says, what'll that do? And the doctor says, I'm mad at my neighbor.
I don't get it.
What if you added something about body issues?
Oh, now I get it.
We should go on the road together.
6 months later.
What do you call someone with one of the worst environmental voting records in the U.S. Senate?
I don't know, Daryl trying to sound like Rachel Maddow. What do you call someone with one of the worst environmental voting records in the U.S. Senate?
Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa.
I don't know why that joke never works. It was thoroughly vetted with legal.
Pepper Lewis, and welcome to Drool Britannia, the final edition's weekly wrap-up of all things British with the royal baby Prince George.
Good to be here.
George, King Juan Carlos of Spain announced he would abdicate so that Crown Prince Philippe can succeed him. Do you think your grandmother would ever abdicate?
What, thou twat? She won't abdicate. Me, I abdicate 4, 5, maybe 26 times a day.
In other royal news, the biblical monarch King Herod will not be portrayed by Johnny Rotten because his Jesus Christ Superstar production was canceled. Are you a fan of Andrew Lloyd Webber?
Is he the twat who wrote Cats? He should have called it Cunts. Now and forever.
The current hit, 24 Live Another Day, was shot in England and concerns a plot involving American drones.
Well, I think it was greenlit by an American dork. The only good thing in it is the hacker group that exposes American secrets. Reminds me of Edward Snowden.
So you know about mining metadata?
Sure. Your government used to steal me private info when I was inside me mum's twat.
The Rolling Stones are back on tour in Europe. Are you familiar with Mick and Keith?
Is Keith a cunt what snorted up his dad's ashes?
That's the rumor.
He's me idol, he is. When my granddad died, I'd snort him, but I couldn't fit his big ears through me tiny nostrils.
Tickets went on sale for the first Monty Python concert in 35 years. Are you excited? They had a huge influence on your mum and dad's generation.
Well, they're no beyond the fringe, but I like Benny Hill.
Finally, how is your mum, Kate Middleton?
Oh, she wasn't any good in The Other Woman.
Oh, that's Kate Upton. Your mum is Kate Middleton.
Middle? I know fuck all. I can't remember the name of me dad either, the bald one.
Prince William.
Everyone around me is a bleeding prince or a queen. What is this, Maleficent?
You're a royal.
They're a royal pain in the twat, they are.
We'll be right back after this with the Final Edition Radio Hour.
Welcome back to the Final Edition Radio Hour, Satire with Teeth.
This is CNN.
Turn on, tune in, drop standards. It's CNN's 10-part series, The 60s, the footage we have the rights to. We've spared no expense to bring you the parts of this tumultuous decade we can get cheaply. Thrill to the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, but without hearing any music.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Relive a short fragment of the Kennedy assassination that's in the public domain. See someone who looks like Lyndon Johnson.
Get the f*** out of my face!
Hear someone who watched the Smothers Brothers.
I liked it. I still do.
See the Jimi Hendrix version of the Star Spangled Banner's influence on another, less talented guitar player's Star Spangled Banner. Watch an in-depth, two-part, four-hour interview with someone who knows a guy who owns the DVD to the 2009 Dimitri Martin movie, Taking Woodstock.
If you watch the movie, it's not quite the same scene. The movie has a split screen of people playing in the mud and other people beating on, you know, wine bottles.
Produced by Tom Hanks, who brought you fake 60s music in That Thing You Do.
CNN, we're almost news.
The NFL is seriously considering opening several foreign franchises, including England, the birthplace of football, or soccer as we Americans call it. American football, as the British call football, has become wildly popular in the UK. The Final Edition ran to ground billionaire British sports entrepreneur Vladimir Vasily Tartakovsky Vichevich, leading contender to operate a British NFL franchise. Our sports reporter Bud Weevil has the scoop.
Mr. Tartakovsky Vichevich, you got an interesting name. It isn't typically British.
Yeah, I was born in Murmansk.
But you have a Cockney accent.
Well, when in Rome, you know.
So, Mr. Tartakovsky Vidovich.
Call me Vladcock.
Okay, so Vladcock.
No. Cock is a familiar form of demotic address, isn't it? As in, hello, me old cock.
Okay, so Vlad, me old cock. What is the appeal exactly of American football to the English?
Well, in order of importance to the average British sports hooligan, the staggering amount of random violence.
Well, most American football coaches would dispute that it's random.
What? Two huge blokes grabbing each other's helmets by the handles?
I'll have you know those handles are face masks.
Yeah, well, they give you a good solid grip, don't they? Then they try to twist each other's heads off of their spinal column. That's great, that is, that's great.
Well, actually, that's a face mask penalty, and it's illegal.
Illegal? It's hilarious! You give these blokes fucking great helmets to protect their heads, then put handles on them so they can twist each other's heads off. Now that's a sport worth watching. Ka-ching!
Well, violence is not the point of our national sport.
Yeah, well, it will be in British American football. Twisting someone's head off while laughing yourself sick is every British sports fan's fondest dream.
You don't understand the complex quasi-military strategy that takes place on the football field.
Listen, Cock, you don't become a Russian billionaire not understanding complex quasi-military strategy. Like, someone poaches on your turf, you run him and his family over with a tank. Guy with the biggest tank wins. Just like American football.
Look, I'm close to bailing on this interview because you're a fucking big-time cock. But I will persevere. Now, what else appeals to British sports fans about American football?
Watching really big men bend over in really tight pants.
You mean when the teams gather on the line of scrimmage for the snap?
Call it what you like, mate. What we like is when they twerk their buns at you, then they all headbutt each other.
That's not headbutting. The snap is when offensive and defensive strategy really come into their own.
What, you mean when they slam their shoulder pads into each other's kidneys, rip the shirts from their opponents' backs, and try to tear off the quarterback's arm?
What you are watching are exhaustively planned split-second moves by superbly conditioned athletes. Championships are won or lost on their execution.
Bollocks. American football is a couple of hours of semi-organized tribal war without actual homicides taking place, which is why it's the best sport ever.
I thought the British had class, appreciation of the finer things. Turns out you're a nation of barbarians.
You've been watching too much Downton Abbey, Cock.
I certainly hope the NFL does not grant you a franchise, Cock. I will do all in my admittedly limited power to prevent that travesty.
Too late, Mr. Weevil. British American football is a done deal. Teams are already in summer training. The Essex Executioners, the Birmingham Big Buggers, the Newcastle Kneecappers, Manchester United.
Sunday, Monday, happy day. Hey, I'm Henry Winkler for Reverse Democracy. In regular democracy, it's one man, one vote. In reverse democracy, it's two men, 21 front groups. Who's behind reverse democracy? Coke-a-mundo! David and Charles Coke, the Potsy and Ralph Malf of scumbag billionaires. They own more politicians than the Fonz owns Combs. Hey. Under reverse democracy, you make no financial contribution to government whatsoever, except when you buy Coke products like Dixie Cups or stock in the Keystone XL pipeline. In regular democracy, laws are written by uncool public servants. In reverse democracy, laws are written by whoever's in ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Whoa! So, don't jump the shark. Join reverse democracy today. Because so far, the Coke-funded Americans for Prosperity only has $125 million to attack regular democracy candidates. And if you're not interested in the three branches of reverse democracy, which are voter suppression, climate change denial, and making up stuff about Obamacare, sit on it. This is the Fonz saying Benghazi ya mundo.
Thank you. welcome Santa Cruz chapter of Friends of the Humpback Whale to another of our whale spotting voyages off the beautiful Central California coast.
Hi.
Great. Good to see you. Of course, we all know and love the legendary Songs of the Humpback Whale. But you know, what are far less known and in their way just as beautiful are the farts of the humpback whale.
Really?
Oh, wow.
There's one of the lovely creatures now. Perhaps we'll get lucky. Unlike the humpback's songs, which can only be heard underwater, its farts are quite audible at sea level. You see, they come up to the surface to fart.
Well, I suppose that's some rudimentary form of courtesy to other whales.
That's a pretty thought. Oh, there she blows!
Is that a spout?
Like a spout. It's hot air becoming vapor ahead of the actual fart. With luck, we're about to hear one.
Will we be able to smell it, too?
The farts of the humpback whale do not smell. Oh, hark!
That is so haunting.
I know. The richness, the profound power. It's like a mighty organ of the sea.
Well, it comes from an organ.
To me, it speaks volumes.
It's sure releasing volumes.
Greg, stop being a smartass. You're spoiling it for people.
There's another spout.
I always thought the spout came from its blowhole.
It's just a different blowhole.
The sheer majesty of it is mind-blowing.
What happens if you light one of their farts?
Actually, humpback whale farts are so powerful, you can light them underwater.
Wow. Has anyone ever done that?
Yeah. There's a group of scuba divers in Malibu dedicated to lighting humpback whale farts underwater. They call themselves the California Fast-Moving Fart Patrol. Oh, look. A whole pod of whales approaching our boat.
Oh, they're coming quite close. How beautiful they are.
Do humpback whales communicate by farting?
Yes, one will fart and another will fart back. Listen.
Why are they surrounding us with their tails towards us?
By turning their backs, they're showing their trust in us fellow mammals. It's a gesture of peace and friendship.
Oh, man, do you smell that? That is friggin' toxic. Something died inside that whale.
Hey, I told you, humpback whale farts are odorless.
Yeah? Well, don't light a match.
I hate to say this, but I think they're farting at us.
It's a whale fraternity, a gesture of fraternal flatulence.
Really? I thought these majestic animals were above this kind of sophomoric humor.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, Lord.
Krill farts are the worst.
With luck, we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Final Edition Radio Hour, a more perfect onion.
Welcome back to the Final Edition Radio Hour. It's time for another talk with Tony. Hey, forget about it. Tony Hendra, our fearless leader, has a good story to tell, and it's a story about creative inspiration and the depths of despair that the creatives can fall into. Those of you out there that consider yourself funny or creative or aspiring to do something special may come away wondering if you have to like vodka and Valium in order to succeed, and also how you wish that your down periods could have such beautiful settings. Nonetheless, it's a great story, and it's from The Moth, which I'm sure you're familiar with. If not, look it up. And now enjoy How Rock and Roll Saved My Life.
It's 1982. I am sitting in a sumptuous beach house in Malibu, watching a magnificent Pacific sunset. And this is shaping up as the worst day of my life. I was in Los Angeles for two reasons. First, to promote my latest satirical publication. And secondly, to appear in a low-budget movie, which was the directorial debut of an old friend of mine. I wasn't terribly keen about this, never having been in a movie, and he had some deranged notion about shooting it like a documentary. The satirical publication was much more my speed. It was a time, as you probably remember, when there was a man in the White House who was talking quite blithely and frequently about a winnable nuclear war against the godless Soviets. And some of us in New York had decided this was a satirical opportunity, and we'd put together this this parody pamphlet of the kind that would inform people of what they could do in the event of nuclear Armageddon, and it was put out by an agency called the Futile Preparedness Agency. And it gave you little tips about what you could do in the event of a direct hit by a 100 megaton bomb on your home. It was called Meet Mr. Bomb. And Mr. Bomb was a very cheery, helpful 1950s hydrogen bomb with a wide smile and good teeth and a firm handshake. Now, Meet Mr. Bomb was quite funny, and Newsweek had said they were going to put it on their cover. So I had, at my own expense, 200,000 copies of this printed up. And I had just heard minutes earlier from my publisher that the largest distributor in the Southwest had read Mr. Bomb, and he had not enjoyed it. He was a Razorback Reaganite, and he had shredded every one of the 100,000 copies I'd shipped to him, refused to pay for them, and since I had no money left to sue him, I was effectively bankrupt. Now, the house I was staying in was to some degree a house of gloom. It belonged to a member of the band. Do you remember that legendary 60s group? I had once believed that the band was the greatest rock and roll group in history, if not the universe. And, of course, they had broken up a few years earlier for the usual egotistical, unnecessary reasons, leaving me bitterly disappointed. And the mood that I was in at that point, this breaking up seemed to me to be symptomatic of the age. Things were breaking up, falling apart. They were coming to an end. Peggy Noonan famously called those years morning in America. To me, they were more like late evening in America. And worse things than that were happening. I mean, a year before that, a deranged fan had shot John Lennon in the street. Not many months before this, a death much closer to home had happened, which was that of John Belushi. And I had given John Belushi his first job, actually, his first starring role in a show I produced for the National Lampoon called Lemmings. And Lemmings was a full-scale parody of Woodstock, at which all the great rock idols got theirs. And John was the sort of satanic MC of all this and was absolutely brilliant. And Lemmings became a big off-Broadway hit. And John was launched on his stellar career and his equally magnificent drug habit, which had just killed him. My first marriage was in ruins, and I knew that basically it was my fault. And it seemed to me somehow appropriate that I was in California. Because California is the end. I mean, it's the end of America. You can't go any further, right? It's after that, it's 5,000 miles of oceanic night, and then you get to China, and it all starts over again. And it was also appropriate that somehow this magnificent sunset was sliding gradually underneath the horizon into Stygian darkness. And for the first time in my life, I just wondered what the hell was the point in going on. Now, whoever owned this house, Robbie Robertson or Richard Manuel, whoever it was kind enough to have left a quart of vodka in it. And I also had with me my very first prescription for Valium. I'd always hated downers, and I'd never taken them, but I'd been sleeping badly, and my doctor said this was the answer. So these two things taken together seemed to me to present a perfect opportunity. So I laid out 10 Valium. I figured that's how many it would take. I took a big slug of vodka, and took my first Valium ever. And then took another slug of vodka. Nothing much seemed to happen. So I took two more Valium. And a really big hit of vodka this time. Still nothing. Clearly this wasn't going to work. I would have to take the remaining seven Valium and get it over with. And so I took a really big hit of vodka to prepare myself for this step, and I picked up the Valium and I looked at them in my hand for a long time. And I fell asleep. And about 14 hours later, I woke. And I was still just as suicidal, but now I had a massive hangover, too. And I remember through the fog that I was supposed to be on a movie set, to be precise, about 4 hours earlier. And it was the last thing in the world I wanted to do, was be in a movie set, and especially a movie about rock and roll, which at this point I hated. And it didn't have a script, this movie. It had to be totally improvised, and I'd never improvised in my life either. But I was a professional, so I jumped in my car and sped across the Malibu Hills and to the location, and they rushed me into hair and wardrobe and so forth and so on, and rushed me to the set, and there were the three stars of the movie, looking absolutely hilarious in their fright wigs. And the set was actually a limo, and I was placed in the limo with them, and somebody yelled, "Action," and we were underway. And they were brilliant. None of them was British, but they all had perfect British accents. And they were being incredibly funny in character, intimidatingly funny. And I knew that very soon, one of them would turn to me and say something, and I would have to answer. Now, I'd done a little homework. I'd read up on improvisation, and I'd talked to all my friends who'd been in improv groups, and the consensus seemed to be that there was one basic rule you had to follow. Listen. You can't bring anything preconceived to improvisation. You must just listen, not just to what people are saying, the other people are saying, but to what their faces are saying, what their bodies and their movements are saying. And if you do that, just simply answer what you hear. It will work. And now the moment came. The character called David was turning to me, and he was saying something to me. And I could see in his face that his character thought my character was pretty sleazy. That this character, whose name was Ian, lied a lot. And out of my mouth came this voice that wasn't really mine. It was sort of evasive and sort of slimily ingratiating. And it had that kind of nasal whine, you know, that was beginning to creep into everyday English. And it worked. It was amazing. I mean, the scene was enabled to continue being funny. I mean, I wasn't funny, but I helped them be funny. And my friend, the director, was very happy with the scene, so we did another take of it, and he was even happy with that. And then we did another scene and another scene, and pretty soon the day was over, and I had completely forgotten all thoughts of offing myself. But more importantly, something quite wonderful was happening, which was these stars and the extended cast, and myself too, we were all in some way on the same emotional page. We had all sort of arrived at this deep disillusion and disappointment with this wonderful music that when we were younger we had such high hopes for, that we actually thought some of us would change things, would bring peace and rationality into life, would end racism and war. You remember? And it had betrayed us, and it had been betrayed for us, and it had been a source of failures and disappointments and vulgarity and stupidity and absurdity and pretension and so on. And this whole cast was just coming into that and devising and finding all these wonderful ways in which venality and cynicism and so forth had poisoned this whole area of the art world. And it wasn't the big sort of comedic set pieces that I loved. It was the little tiny ones where we would find out new dimensions of this. I'll just give you a quick example. This is actually the favorite scene, at least one of the favorite scenes that I'm in. It's sort of in the middle somewhere. It's about Nigel, who's the lead guitarist, being backstage before a concert, and a large amount of food has been delivered to Nigel, and he's not at all happy with it. And he's specifically there's some very small slices of bread which have been delivered with this. And Nigel just doesn't understand. I don't see how the bits of meat, how they're too small. The bread's too small for the meat. Look, you see, it won't work. I want big meat. I want big bread. Okay, and it is Ian's job, my character's job, to talk this moron down, you know, so that he can go out on stage and play the loudest music in the world to brain-dead teenagers, and they keep buying tickets. That's his job. And Ian does it in this kind of mothering, like, he's like a kind aunt, you know? And yet at the same time, it's incredibly cynical, incredibly manipulative, and so on. So anyway, that sort of body of work came together, throughout this. It was just a wonderful, wonderful shoot. And I would actually venture to say that, that Spinal Tap actually isn't a mockumentary. Because of this wonderful cinematographer we had, Peter Smokler, it was actually a documentary record of a really fascinating collective comedic experiment that took place at a certain point in time and couldn't have been at any other point in time. And that was a success. And I think that's why it sort of works. That's where it gets its edge and authenticity. And I have one little epitaph to this. I haven't the foggiest idea what it means, but I'm going to throw it in anyway. This was about 5 years later, and Spinal Tap was sort of had been out for about 3 years and was sort of on its way to becoming the minor classic that it became. And I got into a cab in New York, and my driver was a quintessential acid casualty. I mean, he had one of those beribboned kind of ponytails down to his ass crack, you know. And and he peered in the rearview mirror and he said, "Hey, man, weren't you in Spinal Tap?" And I said, yeah, I played the manager, yeah, he said. And he said, "Oh, man, I really dig their music. It's so far out." He said, "You know, man, I was into Tap before they made that movie."
Hey, Tony.
Yes, Jeff?
So, I just started listening to this show.
What do you mean, this show? The Final Edition Radio Hour?
Yes, the Final Edition Radio Hour.
You just started listening?
Yes.
But you produce it?
I've been busy. Look, it doesn't matter. The point is, I like it. I like this show a lot.
Well, I should hope so.
I mean, it's no car talk or anything, but, you know, it's good. I mean, it's great.
Well, we're glad you like it.
But I wish there was more I could do, you know, besides just listening.
What do you mean?
Well, I know how much work it must take to make great radio like this, and I worry that the Final Edition doesn't have enough fans, enough support, enough...
We're doing okay. We certainly could do better, but, you know.
Tony, come on. Don't be shy. What more can I do as a fan of this show, the Final Edition Radio Hour?
Well, I mean, you could go to thefinaledition.com and check out everything else that we offer.
Oh, cool, thefinaledition.com. Oh, this is great. Oh, we have an album?
Yes, we do.
The Vinyl Edition, cool. Oh, and it's on iTunes and CD Baby. That's awesome.
And it's cheap.
Good, I like that. Cheap greatness. Ooh, there's also a YouTube channel.
Yep, we've got great animation and live action clips and money or die.
So, I could just go to thefinaledition.com and buy the album, or share some of the great articles, or go to the YouTube channel and share those videos.
Of course. That would be great.
And I could tell people about this show, right?
Absolutely. We're on Progressive Voices every weekend, Saturday and Sunday at 8 p.m. East and 5 p.m. West, and on Podbean, and we're syndicated through Rooftop Comedy and PRX.
So, basically, just help spread the word.
Absolutely. Spread the word.
About what again?
The Final Edition, Jeff. The Final Edition. You work here.
Oh, right. Thefinaledition.com.
Thefinaledition.com. We'll be right back after this with the Final Edition Radio Hour.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Zen Koan Heads, the Zen Buddhist game show. It's the only show where we give you the question and you give us a direct insight into the nature of the unknowable. Let's meet our contestants. First of all, our returning champion, Bodhi Tyson. Tyson, are you ready to defend your crown?
To attain is to lose.
That's the attitude. Our next contestant is Taigo Rinzai. He's kept a vow of silence for 30 years now. How do you feel about your chances, Rinzai? You don't say. Because you don't! Little vow of silence humor there. Finally, we have Belinda Clark, a homemaker from Ford City, Pennsylvania. Belinda, are you ready to win?
Oh, you betcha. I want to get a vacation for my family or a new car.
Okay, then. That was awkward. Let's play the game! Our first question, and this is for enlightenment, the question is, how does the mountain walk to the sea? Tyson, you rang in first. What's the answer?
The moon is shining.
That is correct! Tyson takes an early lead. Next question. Put out a fire 100 miles from here. Hey, it's our vow of silence monk, Rinzai. What's your answer, Rinzai? That is correct! Rinzai and Tyson tied for the lead. Belinda still scoreless.
Oh, wait, he didn't say anything, and that wasn't even a question.
Buzzer's ready. Here's your next question. Enter the gateless garden. Belinda rings in.
Okay, none of this makes any sense. It's just weird.
Is that your final answer?
What?
I'm not sure, judges. Oh, I'm sorry. We were looking for an old man came upon a tiger one day. But that was so close, Belinda. And now, it's time for our final question. Here it is. This actor's only Oscar came for his work as a producer of the movie 12 Years a Slave. Belinda!
Oh, I know this. It's Brad Pitt.
Oh, I'm sorry. What we were looking for is this.
Oh, you just hit me with a stick.
We could have also accepted throwing water on you or locking you outside in the snow. Whoa, Tyson and Rinzai are both ringing in.
Yes, we'd like to steal for the win.
You mean you two would like to hit Belinda with a stick as well?
Exactly.
Ow, hey, stop it! Ow! Quit it! Hey! Ow!
That reminds us, all life is suffering. But we'll be back next time. That is, until we solve the riddle of existence. See you then on Zen Koan Hits.
Ow! Ow! Hey! Stop it! Ow! 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 Oh, stop it!
Welcome back to Fox News. Dire news on the economic front. The Wall Street Journal reports that only the top 1% of all wage earners actually work. And only the top 1% of the 1% work hard.
Well, it's no wonder the economy is in trouble. We've got more than 300 million people in this country. Only a quarter are underage, they're retired or unemployed. And out of all that, apparently only 800,000 people actually work at all. And only 8,000 really work hard.
We talked to a few people on the street to see if they felt bad about not really working.
Well, like most people, I was offered jobs as a CEO or an inheritor of huge wealth, but I prefer slacking off as a janitor at three different waste treatment facilities.
I won't apologize. I put in my time making seven figures at a New York financial house. Now I'm finally working at McDonald's like I want. I earn this.
I thought I was working since I have two jobs. But apparently I must not really be working since I'm still homeless.
Well, it's obvious the economy can't sustain itself when 800,000 people are supporting everyone else. We really got to remove the safety net to get people motivated.
So get rid of Social Security.
Oh, it's more than that. Part of the safety net is that the people are getting a paycheck just because they have a job.
Well, that's already been phased out for interns.
Oh, yeah, sure. But people still actually get money for entry-level jobs and middle management.
Even though they don't work.
Even though they don't work.
Well, you can blame that on the Democrats.
Absolutely. Well, coming up, should Walmart greeters count as three-quarters of a person? We'll bring you the answer after this. I say no.
Hey, guys, I don't think we're going to make it back if we don't stop for gas soon. Needle's on empty.
You can drive on empty for 10 miles, Steve. It's a Toyota.
Yeah, but the needle's been on empty since Tuesday.
Oh, there's a gas station up on the right, Steve, just past the next light.
Okay, good. We'll go in there.
No, don't stop, Steve. Keep going.
What's your problem, Jim?
That was a Shell station, Barry. Don't you know what's been going on with Shell in Nigeria? They're propping up a brutal dictatorship which pollutes the country and keeps the people dirt poor without hope. Barry, do you have something against the Nigerians?
Of course not. What are you suggesting?
Okay, don't worry. We'll find another station. Soon, I hope. Oh, the red light on the gas gauge is on. That's bad, right?
There's a Chevron station up on the left, Steve.
I see it. This guy lets me change lanes.
Steve, don't!
Ah! Same to you, buddy.
Jim, what's your problem?
Are you insane? In 2001, Chevron merged with Texaco.
Now that you mention it, Jim, I do remember that merger. And that means what?
For the last 40 years, Texaco has been polluting the Amazon rainforest in Ecuador.
Okay, fair enough. And we're going to stop that from happening how exactly?
No, Jim's right. They're not getting our business. Maybe we can coast for a while. Do you guys have AAA?
Okay, here we go. Mobile station, dead ahead.
Oh, that's perfect. That's just great.
Thank God. I was worried that you were going to tell me not to
Don't
pull
even
over.
Think about it!
Ah!
Remind me never to drive cross-country with you, Jim.
Mobile? Exxon Mobil? As in the Exxon Valdez? The oil spill that destroyed Prince William Sound in Alaska? That Exxon Mobil? Why don't we just strangle some pelicans?
No, he's right, Barry. We can just walk the rest of the way.
We're going to run out of gas, Jim.
Well, maybe we should run out of gas.
I see your point, Jim. I really do. But is walking the last 8 miles home really going to make the world a better place?
We should all be riding bicycles like they do in Europe.
You know what a gallon of gas costs in Europe?
I have no idea.
Well, what do you know, Steve? Up on the left looks like an Arco station.
Arco, you say? All right, then. Can't think of anything bad about them.
Arco? Arco? Owned by BP? Of BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico fame? Anybody heard of it?
Jim, I agree with you completely. We need to send BP a message. Starting tomorrow.
Steve's right. Let's boycott them immediately after we fill up.
Good idea, Barry. That'll show them.
Why did we pull in here, Steve? It's British Petroleum. The largest oil spill in history. But I guess it's not that big a deal, is it? Because you need gas.
Jim, it's Arco. I don't think Arco had anything to do with that one. Plus, their gas is cheaper. We wouldn't be giving them as much of our money.
What do you mean, our money?
We cannot reward BP after they spilled 5 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico.
I think that oil went away eventually, didn't it? Besides, we're in California. That's like Mississippi. They're still trying to keep people from voting.
Nice try, Barry.
Anybody need anything in the AMPM? I feel like a donut.
Steve, please think about it.
You're right. I shouldn't eat donuts.
We cannot buy gas here.
What do you suggest, Jim? Where can we buy gas? We have to go somewhere.
Let's go back to the mobile station.
But ExxonMobil polluted Alaska.
Yeah, Jim, you said that yourself.
Well, you know what? I'm sick of Alaska.
Me too.
Me too.
ExxonMobil. We're sick of Alaska, too.
And finally, to leave you in a mellow mood, here is a comedy classic from the glory years of the National Lampoon, Deteriorata, first recorded in 1972. The music for this was written by Christopher Guest, the vocals were by Melissa Manchester, and it was performed by Norman Rose, a magnificent voice actor of the time. The words were written by yours truly. So here it is, Deteriorata.
You are a fluke of the universe. You have no right to be
placidly amid the noise and waste, and remember what comfort there may be in owning a piece thereof.
Avoid quiet and passive persons unless you are in need of sleep. Rotate your tires. Speak glowingly of those greater than yourself, and heed well their advice, even though they be turkeys. Know what to kiss and when. Consider the two wrongs never make a right, but the three do. Wherever possible, put people on hold. Be comforted that in the face of all aridity and disillusionment, and despite the changing fortunes of time, there is always a big future in computer maintenance.
You are a fluke of the universe. You have no right to be here. Whether you can hear it or not, the universe is laughing behind your back.
Remember the Pueblo. Strive at all times to bend, fold, spindle, and mutilate. Know yourself. If you need help, call the FBI. Exercise caution in your daily affairs, especially with those persons closest to you. That lemon on your left, for instance. Be assured that a walk through the ocean of most souls would scarcely get your feet wet. Fall not in love, therefore. It will stick to your face. Gracefully surrender the things of youth, birds, clean air, tuna, Taiwan, and let not the sands of time get in your lunch. Hire people with hooks. For a good time, call 606-4311. Ask for Ken. Take heart amid the deepening gloom that your dog is finally getting enough cheese, and reflect that whatever misfortune may be your lot, it could only be worse in Milwaukee. You are a fluke of the universe. You have no right to be here. And whether you can hear it or not, the universe is laughing behind your back. Therefore, make peace with your God, whatever you conceive him to be, hairy thunderer or cosmic muffin, with all its hopes, dreams, promises, and urban renewal, the world continues to deteriorate. Give up.
You are a fool.
The Final Edition Radio Hour is performed at one time or another by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earl, Rob Gordon, Tony Hendra, Jeff Hendrick, Kevin Janis, Jeff Chrysler, Barry Lank, John Marshall, Ebby Parker, Rachel Rauch, Steve Rosenfield, Ann Tuchel, and Darby Worley. The Final Edition Radio Hour is written, at one time or another, by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earl, Rob Gordon, Tony Hendra, Jeff Hendrick, Jeff Chrysler, Barry Lank, John Marshall, Ebby Parker, and Steve Rosenfield. The Final Edition Radio Hour is produced by Tony Hendra and Jeff Chrysler, West Coast producer Barry Lank. The Final Edition Radio Hour is edited and audio produced by Greg Russ and Andrew Hammond. The Final Edition Radio Hour is the property of the Final Edition LLC, copyright 2014.